Any questions?
So that thing about stickiness. So I was thinking about how the stickiness of the other kind around negativity.
Yeah.
And just from my own experience that it's not so much the negative emotion, but it's the addiction to that almost. So it's like the stickiness of jealousy or whatever it is, and yeah, so it's quite like a strong competition.
Yeah.
The stickiness.
Yeah.
And that I found that just trying to deal with that in a rational way, or like be good and don't be jealous, like it really, or trying to work it out rationally doesn't help at all. And that so much of it is to do with childhood and infancy and the psyche, that it's just a waste of energy trying to do it in this rational way.
Yeah.
But that stickiness is really something else.
One of the things that when I was saying like forgiveness of life or forgiveness of our vulnerability is partly those sort of forces that happen to us human beings, that we could get caught up in why should it have to be so, but we could also, not working it out rationally, but in that moment, sometimes we can feel all the way through to the bottom of where that force comes from, that force towards addiction. So, like Pramaji was saying, that first acceptance, there, this is addiction, okay? And then kind of again, opening up and getting some fresh air, okay? This is still addiction, but with fresh air, what? Not why should it be so, but why? Why? And not why historically, why? But. And I think that we do hit that what we think is what we experience as a vulnerability. And if we dare to like get through the membrane inside the experience of vulnerability, which partly can be like, this is so sticky, I can't make myself not be jealous. So in other words, we get that the ego or any whatever kind of force it is, the control freak can't control itself. The ego can't control itself. So, but not again turning away from the situation. Okay, sticky. There's a little bit like, okay, so what? Sticky, but at the same time, what? What? I think there's a kind of pervasive, so that's like all the time, everywhere, kind of hidden self-pity is another way to, that. So we say vulnerability, and we've started now culturally, collectively, to get used to that word. So even though we don't like it too much, but kind of, yeah. But so now we need to have another word to notice, actually, it's self-pity. Or we can say there's not the connection to some kind of confidence. Not so much confidence in myself or because I did it so well before, but just anyway, why not? And so if there's a wound that's partly involved, like there's hurt and then that trying not to be with that, and then we get caught up. Then if we can come towards healing as if from above and from below. So from above is where, okay, it's not very helpful to think it through logically, but sometimes it's better than nothing to talk myself through. Sometimes, at least for 5 minutes, then I don't repeat myself. I can talk through, or I can talk through, okay, what is the function of this jealousy? What is it trying to do? It's got some kind of caring in it somewhere, very twisted, but some kind of protectiveness and care that's gotten really twisted. And feeling that, and then, okay, kind of talking to that force that's all twisted. And we can do this, like the practice of loving kindness. That's all from the top surface. Trying to let the mind hear something that it resonates with enough to go, oh, okay, and try a different alignment for a few moments, and then it gets back to its sticky addiction. And so, what is from below? That's harder to talk about, but just because it's harder to talk about, I would like to still not avoid the subject. I think it's usually avoided. Because somehow, even in spiritual teachings, still we want it somehow to make sense to the ego or to the part we think we are. It should somehow make sense, or we're just not going to talk about it. So, but if we kind of get that those forces don't make sense or not interested in sense, it's not only each one of us as a personal failure against that force. Like you said, did you say competition? And we will always lose if we're just directly competing with that. From below, so to speak, like healing as if from below. Does that make sense? Does it make sense? Does it, let's see. Should I say it in another way, or is it good enough?
Say it in another way.
Okay. Usually what happens, we get interested in maybe meditation or anything, any sort of technique, psychology of some kind or whatever. And if we're lucky, at first it seems to be really helpful. And then it doesn't anymore. Usually after at most 3 years. And that's because we're trying to trade one programming for another programming, instead of actually trusting that there could actually be freedom that's free. So when we're using technique, and we're primarily using technique, then let's see. Maybe it's a little bit like a story one of my teachers told, where there was a mother and child, and the mother got sick. And the mother loved her garden. And so she just, before she fell unconscious, asked the child, please take care of my flowers. And so the child knew that taking care means giving lots of kisses. And so the child went to the garden every day, morning and evening, and gave lots of kisses to every single petal and leaf. And it was so terrifying and frustrating and devastating as each day the flowers got more and more. Bent and dried and disappearing. And luckily, the mother woke up just in time to ask the child, have you watered the plants? Watered the plants? How do you water the plants? They don't have mouths. And her love of the plants, let's say she jumped out of bed and started watering the plants and she was better. The plants probably loved being kissed. And we're attracted towards that level of doing what we already know somehow, but not watering the roots. So reprogramming the mind can help a little temporarily, so that we could have a chance for there to be a gap where we feel unprogramming. We feel that more wild, that more ventilated experience, and we know that's life. Does that make sense? And so part of the from below or watering the root is recovering your natural ways. There's a teacher who I quoted earlier, Lee Brasington, who teaches concentration states from the Buddhist tradition. Well, they're not actually from, they're from the human experience that have been described in the Buddhist tradition. They were already being practiced and passed on way before Gotam came along as well. But anyway, on his retreats, people will come maybe for the first time and they'll hear the descriptions and they'll maybe even have some experience of these, let's say, special states. And then they'll say, he says about 25% of people who come for the first time say, I remember this from childhood. And I have the feeling that the other 75% just don't remember. Maybe after some time they will remember. Oh, that's that flavor. So yesterday when we talked about the rebel thing, noticing when you feel, I want to use the word unventilated, so not breezy, not enough. That here, one of the best things about this place, and there are so many good, so many best things, but the way that so often the air is just very tall and lightly moving. It's even in the Yog Vashisht, in one place, a help for meditation is that the air would move just so, not too fast, not too slow, through the room where one is meditating. And so that's maybe a good hint, but it's also the kind of flavor of maybe when we're in the flow. And when we start to stick to a kind of rule of some kind, usually we don't realize. Sometimes we're really trying to stick to the rule. We think we should. We're supposed to feel joy with every drop of tea or every time. And therefore we don't. So just to recognize the different ways that you experience non-breezy, non-ventilation. It's really a natural, it's recovering a natural sense of following a rule unnecessarily, getting sticky with something unhelpful. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So starting to recover the sense of the breezy so that we can keep following our natural way and not just getting back to that thing that happened naturally as a child, but from there as a starting point, what comes? one of the important aspects of this, let's call it healing from below, maybe, seems to be just about the atmosphere that we're in. So it could be the people, it could be the nature, it could be both if we're lucky. More than what anyone is doing or saying, but just the atmosphere. And that could be worth playing with in the ways that we can also influence or create atmosphere to be in. Not just sort of purchasing, like going around as a consumer for good atmosphere. That's also can be a good practice to notice what's the atmosphere and let your amoeba-like sense let you land and stay in the good one, as if you're so lucky and as long as you can. But not only is that like, but also the flow through. Is empowering and cleansing and humbling and so many things. And it can take so little for atmosphere. If in our atmosphere there's really friendliness, which in other words is really some at least hint of the fact of non-separateness in the atmosphere, which is one reason that nature can work well, because it's all getting all mixed up, eating itself and feeding itself constantly. So maybe I will read a poem by Wendell Berry that I thought I would read yesterday. Just if we can, there's one word that I hope we won't take and feel hurt by. And so I'll explain that one. This is another poem from his collection of what he called Sabbath poems. So they're poems that he wrote on his day of rest. And for him, they're all around his practice of, while working as a farmer and a poet and an activist, also the experiences of rest. Deep rest, so who knew? Someone from nearly the next state from where I grew up was writing hundreds of poems about deep rest before I came to India. This is a bit later poem, more recent. If you love it, do not photograph the woods as it now is. And it's the word photograph that I want you not to feel hurt by. So sometimes taking a photograph can be in the flow, of course. So he's using it a little bit as a, like a, we have this word grouch, kind of. All these young people coming around with all their electronic devices. But he's also using it in another way. So trying to capture something because we love it. And he's saying, if you love it, do not photograph. Don't try to catch it. Don't leave your in-ness participation in the woods to try to catch it, to keep it, to have it. If you love it, do not photograph the woods as it now is. And the word photograph is perfect because, and this is the root of the addiction and stickiness, because the photograph is me observing that. I've left it to get it, and I've lost it. So that's the root. It's also the healing. So it's that simple. And that doesn't mean easy. But. If you love it, do not photograph the woods as it now is, the leaves in sunlight and shadow, hardly stirring. The leaves in sunlight and shadow hardly stirring in the air of the hot afternoon. Do not try to remember it, stopping the flutters of leaves and wings, the dead leaf slowly spinning on an invisible thread. Do not ask the trees to linger even to be named. Linger is stay around. Stick. Do not ask the trees to linger even to be named. You must live in the day as it passes, willing to let it go. You must set it free. You must forget this poem. Then, into its own time forever gone, it is forever here. So it's also the Jacques Lucerin trick of letting it stick to us. So whatever it is, we can unravel the jealousy or whatever the program is. We can unravel it back to let it stick to you. Whatever it is you think you don't have and want. In the poem, is there anything I didn't translate that I would translate? It's okay. So the possibility of that experience of flow and love as exactly not recording it, as exactly not stepping outside to observe it. Because maybe we're so not having it, but we're so had by it. And the goodness of being had by it, of it sticking to us. So being in the flow, being in an atmosphere where there's less of photograph, less of observer, and more of direct, what Krishnamurti calls direct perception. And we can feel maybe in our own experience that even a half second of that directness gives a lot. It's not, we're not necessarily talking about sort of maintaining something for so long. We're not going really that much into time. And feeling how even a split second of that kind of love or flow or direct, non-observing, being in, goes a long way. And then gradually, what else would we possibly want to be up to than being had? So healing from below, being in an atmosphere, friendliness, non-observation. And that ventilation, the breeziness, which leaves room for, rather than kind of building up that compartment of rebellion that then explodes, it's continually active. And so at rest and potent, there's a potency, which you may have noticed when sometimes you're resting and then you're like, whoa, with the energy of aliveness and resting more and more energy. So Krishnamurti's, one of his main points in that conversation of how are you going to know for yourself? How are you going to know that it's direct perception that you're resonating with from the bottom up and not from the top down? Something that happens and later makes sense rather than makes sense and then happens. Does that make sense? We want it to make sense first and then happen, except that that's the control freak. That's my imagined version of meditation. And when it happens and then later makes sense, we don't want to believe that sense. We don't want to believe that that they're describing is what I experienced as a child. And that that's enough. That so lightness of touch, that breeziness, that that's enough. So that here's the stickiness. We've gotten so used to, we want to have something to kind of lean against, some kind of boundary, even if it doesn't exist. And what makes the boundary, is fear. What makes the boundary seem to be. And so another part of the healing from above and below, I think it works from both sides, is where we're letting our alarm system come down, or we're releasing trauma. So where there's been overwhelming experience, which in a way all of us have experienced, because at some point as a baby we didn't get what we, it felt like we were going to die because there's no food or no mom or no whatever. And then that, the no starts, the against thing starts to happen and build. And so Krishnamurti's main point is one sort of really helpful aspect of honesty is that there's not reassurance. There's not someone saying, don't worry, I promise you it's going to be all right. I promise me, also. That if I do this and I keep doing it and I just don't stop doing it however much I hate it, if I keep doing it, then somehow I'll find out what I am. And if we can just get the illogic of that, how could it, by being against me, that I could be in contact with me, whatever me may be? And so unraveling. And then again, feeling, what is that drive towards the reassurance? Reassurance means it's going to be okay. It could be different to discover it is okay, that place that's not hurt, when even though there is so much hurt. And from the not hurt, to allow that tenderness to have all the hurts, all of them. And slowly, slowly to bring them in to love. And so as we practice doing our best to bring the alarm system down, let the breath drop, feel the ground. Is it possible to feel the ground? A little bit. Is it possible to feel the feet? A little bit. Is it possible to feel respect or love a little bit? And then as it starts to unravel, one of the things that often can come, and we think we get all confused because we think it's not supposed to come, is anger and rage. Also restlessness in the body, or power in the body that's not sure of itself. What's it going to do? What's going to happen? And that's where literally the animal body knows what to do. So sometimes we can use the phrase animal body to help us get out of the programming and let something different happen. But literally the animal body knows that shaking and letting the body go hot and cold and nauseated, and letting it run and jump and feel its legs, and how that helps the mind find not only the difficult. So this is the difference. We recover that other aspect. We start to be able to have room for both. The beautiful, lovely, wonderful, clear, powerful. And of course that immediately calls for, not immediately, but eventually in its own time, in its ripeness, calls for anything that's hurt come to the tenderness. Of course it comes to the tenderness. Tenderness is bigger now, has more capacity, has enough energy to bear the release of that pain. And then that energy is released, there's more power in our, we can bear that much beauty, brightness, clarity, lightness. We don't need the reassurance as much. Krishnamurti says what he's, when he calls direct perception. Is the same as insight, but in a deep way that then we don't have to keep clearing away. It's clear. A little bit like, don't think it's something you haven't experienced. That sounds like a way off in the future kind of experience. It's like if for the first time you came into this room in the dark and the electricity was off and you just had to fumble your way, you had to find your way. And then the electricity came on and you could see the room. And you saw, oh, there's my bag. Someone put my bag there for me. And there's a chair. And there's the door. And there's the other door. And then the electricity went off again. You would still have a good sense of where your bag is and where the door is. Unless you got panicked. I've brought Jacques again. He's older now. He's a young teenager. And he so sweetly describes sort of the last innocent years where, as a boy, he could still hang out with the girls, especially as a blind boy. And then kind of suddenly, he said, the bad boys and the pretty girls were gone. And so he and his best friend, Jean, spent a lot of time together. Between 13 and, I don't know if he says 16 or 18 or whatever. And one of the things they do is they go on hikes. And so for Jacques, it's so normal how he lives his life. And so he describes playing games with the other children and running around. And only later does he mention, of course, to run, I need someone. So he's running around, he's blind, and he holds on to someone, and they run together. And I love how he describes that usually we would think children, oh, they're so cruel. They would never put up with having a so-called invalid in their games. And he said, not at all. More they fought over who could be the one who had the turn to be his runner, so to say. So he and Jacques would hike in the mountains. We had been climbing in shale, so kind of like slippery rock, and brush, like Israel. Low kind of bushy stuff. Tiny trees, maybe. Along the side of a hill above the Seine Valley. All of a sudden, having just noticed that the landscape had made a final dip on my right, I said to Jean, just look, this time we're on top. You'll see the whole bend of the river unless the sun gets in your eyes. This is Jacques, who can't see, speaking to Jean, who can. Feeling where they are, seeing where they are, somehow. Do you understand what happened? Just like the English? Yeah. Jean was startled. He's like, what? Opened his eyes wide and cried, you're right. This little scene was often repeated between us in a thousand forms. And if it surprises you, that is only because you forget how hard it is for people who have something, eyes, luck, or happiness to realize it and make use of it. When we came in from our walks, Jean would say to his family, "It's fantastic how many things he made me see to get today." So it's not just that one spectacular time, but many times a day. And then there's the way it wasn't only the outer world that Jacques so many times could see better than could Jean. And maybe it's better if we feel inside that there's a Jacques and a Jean rather than them, those lucky boys. But feeling for that part that it's so, you can clearly feel the difference, for example, between fear and love. You can clearly feel, even if it's subtle, the difference between when it's getting unventilated. It means you're following some kind of should, some kind of pressure, some kind of addiction, some kind of rule that's not the rule of love, which is not a rule. We can clearly feel that, and by feeling it, our sensitivity, we get more clear for next time and more clear. So that means more open for the direct perception to keep happening, where you suddenly think, has that tree been here for 7 days? Right there? So Jacques also is helping Jean to explore inside, so to speak. So Jacques continues, "I should add, but perhaps you have already guessed, that Jean spent hours dreaming." So he spent hours, that's a long time for a teenage boy. He spent hours dreaming, so he spent hours getting lost in his inner experience, maybe in a really good way. He was continually diving down into his inner world. He believed me when I told him that this world, if not richer than the other, was certainly as rich and almost completely unexplored. I had pointed out to him ways to approach it, for I knew the route well, the route, the way in, and now he came very close to going further along it than I. Later, Jacques describes how Jean had the advantage of being young. So it might be good when we're feeling for the inner Jean, that there's that young energy that could otherwise accumulate into the rebel who then needs to feel it's a fight. So before it's a fight, that spirit of the teenage boy or girl. So a little bit later, Jacques says, "If there is a difference between a boy of 15 years old and a man of 40, or 20, I would say, but anyway, I am afraid, alas, that it is to the advantage of the former." So he's saying it's good luck for the younger, because the boy does everything by attention. And he means the same meaning of attention as Krishnamurti. So not by fear and not by plan, but by wildness. By discovery. The man, so meaning that older part that is sticky to the rules, the programming, the man no longer does anything except by habit. Jean knew how to pay attention to the point where nothing could distract him. So, getting the feeling of what is meant by attention. It's not the person by habit trying to create a stronger habit at all. That's exhausting and unsustainable. Despite having permission, why would I be distracted? Because I'm into this. So he knew no distraction, nothing could distract him, neither nightfall. So it didn't matter if it got to be nighttime and then, better go to sleep or something. Neither nightfall nor my endless chattering. So Jacques talking to him all the time. He's still staying with his inner stream. not even hunger. So just feeling for that rhythm that we've developed inside that's not so helpful. For example, maybe after a while we get into that tune of can feel one or two breaths or maybe three. And then, of course, then I think for a while and then one or two or three breaths. And then I think for a while and one or two or three breaths. And I think for a while. Or we allow ourselves to be kind of burned by the intensity of beauty and by the space that happens when we allow beauty to resonate with the beauty inside. And then after a certain time, there's as if the alarm has gone off. Okay, time's up. It must be time for something now. So coming out of that alarm. So the age, or we could say the spirit, where, because it's not, of course, it's not about the body age. The age, the spirit, when you dare to say anything, when you always find someone to listen. I love that detail. The confidence that there could be an intimacy where we can share the deepest and the most interesting and the passionate and the simple. I too knew when to listen to, how to listen to Jean. When one of us was trying to draw an idea out of his head, or a whole scene which stubbornly refused to take shape, the other found that entirely natural. He waited and already understood. Try telling a grown-up person that you don't see things as he or she does! Exclamation point. Beware. So if we could just know that, the sort of Jean-Jacques friendship inside doesn't necessarily need to report everything to the adult inside. The adult inside doesn't know how to listen anymore to anything much but fear. Is there any question or anything to say so far? And so Jean is encouraged by Jacques' cool experiences to also go and find his own. All different kinds of inner experiences. And Jean found it difficult to come out, to come back from the inner back to the outer. And Jacques says, I explained to Jean that it was a preconceived idea which made the process hard for him. An idea, by the way, which almost everyone shares, that there are two worlds, one without, the other within. I kept having to explain all over again because Jean wanted to believe me, but couldn't. The preconceived idea always stood in the way. The preconceived idea that there's an inside and an outside kept standing in the way. So I love the scene of Jean wanting to understand Jacques, and Jacques explaining again and again in that adolescent teenage way. We talked about this at least once a week in the frame of mind of people going to Mass on Sunday, so people going to some kind of sacred space is what he means. After all, it was a religious subject. The reality, the oneness of the world, left me in the lurch, incapable of explaining it, because it seemed obvious. So left me in the lurch, it's like it didn't give any help. I had to find my own way. It didn't give any help. How to explain that there's not inside and not outside when it's just obvious that there isn't. And then Jacques finds a small way, and it referring to that experience of letting things come. So he could only repeat. There is only one world. Things outside only exist if you go to meet them. How does that sound? Instead of saying this is the truth, how does that sound in your experience? We could take it as less of an absolute statement and feel Do things feel more outside of me when I go to meet them? Does it seem more solid, more outside, the more I go to meet them? Does it seem less solid and less outside, the less I go to meet them? Does it? Anyone want to say anything? I find that the more letting it come to meet me, so to say, or simply not going out to meet it, the less of going out to meet, the more a sense of sacred space. So Jacques says, things outside only exist if you go to meet them with everything you carry in yourself. As to the things inside, you will never see them well unless you allow those outside to enter in. So he's saying when we allow what seem to be outside to be part of a continuity of experience, then it's easier to see clearly what's happening in. What do you think? To pass from the inner light to the light of the sun was not the work of the senses. A click sufficed, a slight change in point of view, like turning one's head 1/100th part of the circle. That click was enough, the rest came by itself. To convince Jean, this is mostly, this last little few, two sentences is mostly just to share that my love of their friendship. To convince Jean, which mattered terribly to me, I assembled all my arguments. So I got all my evidence together. I got prepared because the most thing he wanted to do was convince Jean. If he wanted to be completely happy, there must be only one world. For this was the indispensable condition. This joy was well known to me, was the grace of my state of being. And at the same time, I was aware that I had done nothing to deserve it. It had simply been given to me. And he just wished that Jean would have the same gift. So coming back to the opening of the Wendell Berry poem of today, If You Love. I would rather that we start almost with an assumption that there is a spot in us that loves, that does love aliveness. No thing, it just loves. And in that spot, we can feel that breeziness feeling. We can feel how important it is not to always move outside and take the picture, to trust sometimes the staying with and not recording, some other way of, let's say, remembering through just the continuity. And how that stays grounded as well as exalted. It's not an escape from somewhere to somewhere. From there also, there is that kind of joy in the body that does a lot of cleaning for us. That helps, we could call that healing from the middle. We've had above and below and from the middle. We can also practice noticing in a few different ways, and I think that can really help heal from the middle. So I mentioned before sometimes that happening where we notice something that's been there all along, but we just didn't see it. That can be inside or outside. But on purpose, we can also let our eyes be open. We can play with feeling, for example, as if this whole world is my body. Or this and all of this is the body of all body of life, something like that. Or at least nobody owns any of this. And just letting there be as if like a neutral but twinkling eye, like the eye has a sense of humor in it. And then just what stands out, what do the eyes notice? What comes to attention through the eyes or the ears or to the mind? That's starting to practice connecting all the way through. So this might even be where there's healing from below, from above, from the middle, and then this healing of bringing it together. The practice of letting something stand out and not needing to understand or figure out why, but just knowing and feeling that energy of that connection, knowing that is somehow relevant. It might just be the noticing and that's all. It might be that the next thing's gonna happen is the person's gonna come ask you a question and you had a dream about that last night or something, some kind of weird, seemingly weird thing. It seems weird to us. Maybe it isn't. To practice also noticing in general what otherwise is considered neutral by our habit, by our filter. So one of the teachings that's been preserved, a dialogue between the nun Dhammadinna with her former husband before she became a nun. She says many beautiful things, amazing things in her dialogue with her former husband, but one of the things she mentions is that things that come across to us as neutral, so we don't like or dislike, it doesn't cause us pain or pleasure because of our programming, it triggers the neutrality button. By actually then feeling that, noticing that, seeing that, hearing that, that otherwise we wouldn't have heard or seen or felt, inside or outside. So maybe we're used to looking at the food on the plate, but not the plate. Or we're used to looking at the plate, but not the hand. That simple. Or just letting the eyes rest and allowing a little shift of perspective to happen, that you didn't notice that branch, you noticed the leaves, and now the branch. That's all, that shift. She says that in allowing what had been neutral, so in other words, which in a way had been blocked by our filtering, its preciousness had been blocked. By being in touch with it, it's pleasurable. By being out of touch with it, it's unpleasant. So there's a slight unpleasantness in the neutral unless we're in touch with it. When we're in touch with it, it's pleasant, she says. It's worth a try. And to play with how could it be possible to actually notice, to allow attention to happen with those things that we are given, like eyes and luck and happiness. So it's not only by lack that we notice what we don't have. It's so important. It's so important in the inner process and in the so-called outer process, and in allowing that to start to be more and more one thing, one process. It's here that we've held back for a long time. Maybe we realize the greatness of the gifts, and we don't want to be bothered, or that lack of confidence that it's possible to let the greatness of the gift be felt, which means it's almost like we find our wings are 3 times bigger than we thought. And we somehow know how they work. Eyes, luck, happiness. So literally playing with eyes in the ways I've mentioned, for example, that letting the eyes be open, letting it rest, letting attention happen. So that it's not because I have eyes, I actually ignore everything nearly. And getting in touch with our luck can really help to that little egg of self-pity that seems to be maybe the core of personality and suffering. The reason we keep somehow sticking. Somehow getting into fear. Not trusting our system to bear the greatness of the experience, of the gift. It's like as if self-pity in there, which makes tenderness seem to be just vulnerability, weakness, problem, and therefore require fear. It's like the egg doesn't just sort of crack, but it's almost like it just melts, gets soft. The egg of self-pity. So then there's truly a dignity in what has been hurt. It's not an ignoring of that. And there's a real, true sense of that's not all. And then we're not sort of limping along anymore. Almas talks about this as well. The inside, outside. He talks about it in a little bit more psychological way. So it's another perspective on things. And he deliberately wants to challenge the self-pity complex. The sense that my hurt is the thing that defines me. Because it needs protection, because there isn't tenderness. So, he says, aloneness means having no boundaries. So he's calling that experience of not inside, not outside. Instead of calling it sacred space, he's calling it aloneness. So he's trying to make sure we know he's not reassuring. Aloneness means having no boundaries. Your personality is not there. Your mommy and daddy. Sorry, I need to get my light out so I can see my handwriting. So aloneness means having no boundaries. Your personality is not there. Your mommy and daddy are not there. As long as any part of your personality is there, there's the memory of your mom and dad, of the past, of other people. So Papaji used to say, just to give a half second to yourself. So it's another way of saying that kind of dare to go into this, what Almas calls aloneness, or dare to feel, is there really a boundary? And what is the requirement of boundary? Where does that come from? As long as your mind is active, you are not alone. It is not you. So, and then as we start to let the seeming wall crumble, it is not you who dies. So when the survival strategy is called into question and we feel, oh my God, it's the end of the world, that person doesn't like me or whatever, I'm not getting enlightened yet. It is not you who dies. What dies is everyone else. You have lost a boundary constructed from past experiences, but this boundary never really existed. So practicing being available to notice what we haven't noticed before, what stands out, what's neutral, what's subtle, what's given, the full gift of it, undeserved, and the traceless. So another aspect of the stickiness of addiction is that there's a trace, and that's why it's easy to get called back into the same. And starting to get the hang of the call of the traceless, the sweetness of no trace. So that experience of outside inside, because there's no boundary, there's nothing to leave a trace. There's nowhere to be traced upon. And the experience can have tremendous impact, can be very healing, but it's easy to disbelieve it later. And it doesn't give us any help in explaining to ourselves that it really happened, or that it's true, that it's more real than this feeling of self-pity. And as we gradually do the process of unraveling the trauma, so the fear that's locked in the body, the resistance that's locked in the body-mind, we give it its chance to go through anger and fear and find that the anger and fear can come back as power in the body, as resource. More and more of us is at rest and can allow what is to come across. So again, feeling for the place of if you love, so where you love, aliveness, there. Feeling how the movement to take a photograph is extra and closes off the breeze. That's simple. And then feeling how the breeze is true and needed, and something in us starts to know in a felt way, just stay with the breeze. And that breeze means no boundary. It doesn't have to be this spectacular, mind-blowing, on the ground, can't get up experience. It's a breeze. Any questions or comments? Sharing. Yeah, please.
Thinking about eyes.
Yeah.
And using my eyes and not taking them for granted. Yesterday, walking to the lake in the afternoon, I felt a little bit like I was on drugs for a moment, because my perception of the outside world had was heightened.
Yeah.
And I don't know what triggered it, but suddenly colours were standing up more. And I looked down at my feet and all the leaves under my feet. And they were all different colours. And there was bright green and yellow and red and brown. And if I just looked at the leaves as I walked, I felt like I was walking on colours. And when I was sitting by the lake, I was noticing the play of light and shadow on the water and the reflections, the breeze. Everything was just heightened somehow. I don't know what triggered it, but when you were talking about not taking our sight for granted, it came to me that I was looking in it in a new way, and it was really moving and powerful.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I forgot about it today.
Yeah.
And I haven't thought about it, and I haven't tried again.
Yeah. But. So that's just that kind of the traceless quality. It's a noticeable, powerful, beautiful experience. And it's not that we should have to try to remember it either, but just to know that it has that quality of not remembered, because we're so in, we're not recording it. And so then when we want to try to say, okay, how am I doing in my meditation or something like that, we look at what's recorded. And so we're missing the whole where the real practice is going on. It's traceless. Yeah. So we start towards trusting that, the traceless. And then we can hear, like, sometimes the language in, let's say, Zen teachings can sound like as if it's just trying to break our head by being weird, but it's actually possibly describing actual experience where the body is walking through the mind of the forest. The forest is walking past the body. Or the feet are walking on colors. The colors are supporting the feet. Thank you. So that's where you'd start to discover your own, your natural way. And that really helps healing from below. So it could be, other people may have experienced the heightening of the visual in their own way, but it's not that, oh no, if you haven't experienced that, you failed the retreat. And life as well, of course, previously. This is the delicious example. We can feel her deliciousness in that experience and feel for our own deliciousness. And especially where you feel that appreciation, gratitude, love towards outside, if we can kind of just find that little, like Jacques said, that little tiny click shift, as we open some kind of, where there is that resonance inside, and it's as if we're letting what I love me. In the experience of loving that, just letting it love you, so to say. Letting the love resonate equally here as there. Taking out the trapdoor. Yes, please.
I was just, when you were talking, it suddenly made some sense to me, because in the Nirgun tradition, they have this whole form of poetry which is called Unadvasi, which is, it uses words, but it describes the world in a completely, it's not even upside down, it's just completely crazy.
Yeah.
And it's sung. And at the end of that verse, it says that the one who understands knows what I am saying.
Yeah.
And it just struck me that it's actually talking about experience outside of language, and language is structure. It's how you, you know, construct your world, which you're saying as an adult. You've given meaning to certain things, emotions, patterns. You're also thinking like that. So I think it struck me that in that, what it's trying to do is to get you out of that. And in one of those poems, it says that I found Sahib, which is basically I found my connection with, I mean, there's no God in that sense. There's Til Ole. I've just found under a mustard seed. That's when I just found. And again, it's a lot of, it's in the everyday. It's in that moment. It's just in what is around you, what you. So it resonates a lot with that there is. When you said it's not one fantastic moment of enlightenment. It's just that, you know, with just that one touch that you are suddenly connected to everything, and that boundary between yourself and what is around you just goes. And you have that sense of being in it.